This is Democracy,
a podcast about the people of the United States.
A podcast about citizenship,
about engaging with politics and the world around you.
A podcast about educating yourself on today's important issues
and how to have a voice in what happens next.
Welcome to our new episode of This is Democracy. This week, we are going to talk about an age-old but also an urgent issue of our moment today. That is the question of the relationship between the courts in the United States, particularly the Supreme Court, but we might say the judiciary in general, and the executive branch, the presidency. What is the relationship between these two of the three pillars of our democratic republic? How do they relate to one another? And in particular, we're going to look at pardoning power, which is, of course, in the news quite a lot these days, but has a long history. And as with every one of our episodes, this episode will look at how history informs our current controversies and perhaps our current solutions, if there are any. We are very fortunate to be joined by a leading scholar and public intellectual and writer in our country, Jeffrey Toobin. Jeffrey, thanks for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
Jeffrey Toobin is a contributing opinion writer at the New York Times. He's also a senior legal analyst at CNN, and he's the author of numerous books. One of my favorite is it's called The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court, which was published a number of years ago. Jeff's most recent book, hot off the presses, is The Pardon, The Politics of Presidential Mercy. And I can tell you, I just finished reading it this morning, in fact, and I highly recommend it to all of our listeners. Before we get into our conversation, however, with Jeff, of course, we have Mr. Zachary Suri's scene-setting poem. What's the title of your poem today, Zachary?
It is a miracle the earth can twist.
I guess it is. Let's hear about that.
It is a miracle the earth can twist, spinning on a line that isn't there but somehow fits. The land is borderless, and yet frontiers persist. And in the ether one can almost see molecules that don't exist. Likewise is the law that gets to say what's right, what's wrong, that gets to write and beg and plead and sing a righteous legal song. But when day is done and judges sleep, their word is dense and sinks down deep to earth where all erodes and is oft besmeared by common toads.
Wow, that reminds me of a famous quote, but I can't remember who it's from. Maybe you or Zachary can help me. Poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. And that poem put that phrase in my head.
I think that's one of the themes of our podcast, Jeff, which is how much we learn from poetry and the arts. And I think that's an apt way to think about it. Zachary, what is your poem really about?
My poem is about how much of the law and our legal system depends on a sort of faith that legal judgments will be upheld and adhered to, and how at the end of the day, there really isn't much else that keeps the rule of law in force than that kind of trust and faith.
Yeah. Is that correct, Jeff?
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm writing something about almost this exact topic now, which is sort of what is it about our system that makes people comply with, say, Supreme Court opinions? Because the Supreme Court commands no troops. They can't require people to follow what they do, but at least historically, they do. And it's really a matter of culture and norms more than it is any precise statute or even constitutional provision, which is at one level a great thing because it shows we have a common culture, but it's also a fragile thing because there is no enforcement mechanism for a norm. And as we've seen in the past few weeks, that there is no guarantee that norms will last forever.
So J. Michael Luttig, who is a conservative former judge and legal scholar who I'm sure you know well, he's recently written that the courts could actually defeat a president. He sees the courts as having a lot of power. Is he overstating things?
I am a great admirer of Judge Luttig, and he also, he's become a very important public intellectual in the past couple of years. I don't think it's a matter of the courts alone. I think there are always a lot of factors moving in the air at the same time. But on balance, I don't really agree with Judge Luttig. I think power belongs to the powerful, and the branch of government that commands the military, that commands the executive branch, that is the executive, I think is a it's very hard to defeat that power if you don't. If the executive is determined to triumph over the other branches.
Right. You know, I feel as a historian, Jeff, torn on this issue, and your book, which goes through the history of pardoning power, also raised this in my mind. You know, I think of a president like Franklin Roosevelt, who certainly was able to pressure the court over time to approve things he wanted them to approve. But then I think of a president like Dwight Eisenhower, who very reluctantly had to send forces into Little Rock, for example, to enforce Brown versus Board of Ed and other cases. So it seems as if the historical examples pull us in two directions. There are times the court is able to influence presidents, and there are obviously times the president is able to influence the courts.
Well, that's true, although, you know, the real secret to Franklin Roosevelt's success was not any persuasive act. It was just getting elected and elected and elected. he wound up with 8 Supreme Court appointments. He filled 8 seats on the court, 1 seat twice. And I think that's what really got the New Deal approved. It wasn't, you know, the persuasive power of his arguments. And as for Dwight Eisenhower, you know, I happen to be looking at the Little Rock crisis just now and for something I'm writing. And it really was Herbert Brownell, his attorney general, mm-hmm. who said, look, we don't love the Supreme Court. We don't love Earl Warren, but we have to enforce the law as set down by the court. So in that respect, it is an example of the persuasive power of the courts, but that varies by president, and sure. As I think we all know, that issue is very much up for grabs right now.
Yes, Zachary,
it's certainly become common to say in the last few weeks that the sort of political situation we find ourselves in, particularly as regards the relationship between the presidency and the judiciary, is unprecedented. From your perspective, how unprecedented do you think these challenges are today, and what makes this moment unique, if it is?
Well, I think I'm going to weasel out of answering your question because I think it's important to remember how early we are in President Trump's second administration. And, it is of course true that the president and his administration, including especially Vice President Vance, have sent mixed signals about how much and whether they will abide by decisions of the lower courts, at least. And but we're going to know a lot more about that in a matter of weeks and certainly months as these cases start to move through the appellate process. I think there's some posturing going on right now, but on the part of the administration. I think their attempts through that posturing to influence the results that they get in court. But I don't think we know exactly how the challenges to judicial authority will play out. And I think that's the heart of your question, which is, you know, are we in an unprecedented moment of conflict between the executive and judicial branches? And the answer to that is, you know, we'll know soon, but we don't know now.
What would be the costs to Donald Trump or any other president for that matter in disobeying the courts and doing what Andrew Jackson didn't do, but is apocryphally claimed to have done, to say, you know, John Marshall has made his decision, now he can enforce it. What would be the cost if Trump were to do that for Trump?
Well, the cost would be that, you know, there is still in this country, even in a Republican Party that is overwhelmingly in President Trump's thrall, a belief that the structure of our constitutional system requires a final arbiter for controversies, and that final arbiter is the United States Supreme Court. This has been true since 1803 and the decision of Marbury versus Madison. To ignore that is to open a door to a kind of chaos that might actually redound to his detriment at some point. Because, you know, it's worth remembering in the big picture, this is a Supreme Court with 6 conservatives, 3 Trump appointees. In the vast majority of cases, they are going to side with Trump. If people think that those opinions are no longer binding, that's something that could really create a kind of chaos that would not be helpful. That would not be helpful to Trump. But on the other hand, if he defies the courts on some issue that is really important to him, that risk may be worthwhile. It's tough to answer that question in the abstract, but you know, without identifying what issue would provoke such a confrontation. But you know, I, to answer your question, it would not be costless for Trump to defy the courts.
Right. Well, I think at the root of your answer, Jeff, is that there still is a consensus and a belief in many parts of our country across parties in the rule of law. We might disagree on what the rule of law is, but it does appear as if there still is a belief in the rule of law, which brings me to ask a question about your brand new book, The Pardon. And I just want you to maybe recount for our listeners, why do presidents have pardoning power? Why is that within our rule of law when, as you say at the start of the book, correctly, of course, this is a kind of old royal prerogative that somehow made its way into the Constitution?
Right. Another way of saying the same thing is that the pardon power is an anomaly because, as most people know, the basis, you know, the underlying idea of the Constitution is the idea of checks and balances. And, you know, with the different, the judicial, the legislative, and the executive power, you know, rubbing against each other in some sort of, you know, balance. The pardon is an exception to that. There is no check and balance on the pardon power. The courts can't interfere with a pardon. They can't force a pardon. Same thing with the legislature. This came up largely through the initiative of Alexander Hamilton, who in the Constitutional Convention was the leading advocate of a strong president to replace the Articles of Confederation that had no president at all. And Hamilton had two main ideas that, you know, underlying his belief in the pardon power. The first was he thought there was a need for the president to ameliorate unduly harsh criminal sentences, which is, you know, pretty straightforward, and that's remained one factor in pardons. But the other, I think, is more interesting, is he recognized that it was a political tool that presidents could use, especially in situations where there were rebellions or protests. The president could use it to calm those protests, to say, you know, I understand what you're doing, but I'm not going to prosecute you for your beliefs. And that came up almost immediately after George Washington became president and we had the Whiskey Rebellion, which was a modest tax protest way out west at the time, which means Pennsylvania. Right. And that, and instead of prosecuting the protesters for treason or something like that, Washington pardoned them. And that was, I think, a very successful use of the pardon power. Likewise, in a much more consequential way, Abraham Lincoln, after the Civil War, issued an amnesty, which was a kind of group pardon, to the lower level soldiers on the part of the South, as long as they pledged allegiance to the Union. And what that meant was he could begin the work of bringing the country together. So, you know, the point I make in the book is that from the very beginning, pardons weren't just about mercy. They were about the exercise of presidential power, for better or worse, depending on how good you think the pardon is.
Right, right. And the Abraham Lincoln, Andrew Johnson comparison that you make in the book, actually, and that I and others have written about is, of course, instructive, right? Andrew Johnson also issues the Christmas Day pardon of December 25th, 1868, I think, right? Which actually allows a whole series of Confederates to come back into government, right?
And he pardons Jefferson Davis.
Exactly.
The president of the Confederacy, which outraged the radical Republicans who had been, you know, Lincoln's biggest supporters. And again, it just underlines it underlines another theory behind my book, which is that pardons tell you a tremendous amount about presidents, that
yes,
they offer an x-ray into the souls of presidents. And the fact that Abraham Lincoln did not pardon the high-level Confederate leaders, and Andrew Johnson did, tells you a tremendous amount about the difference between Lincoln and Johnson.
Absolutely.
And that kind of information carries forward to all the presidents who followed.
And much of your book, really the meat of your book, focuses on President Gerald Ford's pardoning of his predecessor, President Richard Nixon. I'm going to let our listeners read your detailed account of what you call a good man acting for good reason on Ford's part, making a bad decision. But what struck me in reading this is really until then, and really, as you say, until Clinton's presidency, Bill Clinton's presidency in the late 1990s, presidents don't use pardoning power very much. Why does it pick up again? Why do we see more pardons starting with Clinton going forward?
Well, let's just talk in rough terms about eras. In the 19th century, you know, particularly the latter half of the 19th century, there were a lot of pardons because there was no other way of people getting out of prison early except by pardon. But then in the 1920s, parole came in, and that offered a release valve for deserving prisoners to get out, and presidents felt less of a need to pardon, and pardons went down. Then you have, in 1974, Ford's pardon of Nixon, which was incredibly politically controversial, widely believed to have very negative political consequences for Ford, including perhaps the loss of the election 2 years later to Jimmy Carter, and presidents shied away from pardons. And that really continued through much of into the 90s and even into the next period. I mean, yes, there were some pardons like the Mark Rich pardon by Bill Clinton, which was, I think, considered pretty disastrous. George Herbert Walker Bush's pardons of the Iran-Contra defendants, also not highly respected. And it's only recently that we've seen this, you know, pickup of pardons with, you know, Joe Biden pardoning his son Hunter and then other members of his family. And of course, Donald Trump pardoning the 1500 plus January 6th rioters. Those are all controversial pardons. And yes, it's true, there are more of them. But my belief is that those pardons will not wear well historically, and I could see other presidents shying away from it again because I don't think the Hunter Biden pardon or Donald Trump's pardons of the January 6th people and the ones he's issued since then will be a part of Trump's legacy that other presidents will want to emulate.
I guess what I was getting at with the question also was, is this another sign of the rise of what some of us have called the imperial presidency, where presidents are using pardons and war-making powers and various other elements of their repertoire, using them more often to assert supremacy over other branches of government?
I am certainly a believer in your general idea that presidents are, exerting their power a great deal more than they used to. I mean, there is a provision in the Constitution that only Congress can declare war, but we haven't had a declaration of war since World War II, and we sure seems to have had a lot of wars that have been initiated by presidents. And that's, an example of how they exercise a great deal more power than they used to. I think Trump in particular likes the pardon power because he doesn't have to deal with anyone on it. He doesn't have to persuade Congress to do anything. He doesn't have to worry about what the courts will do. This is something he can do like he used to fire people on The Apprentice. He has unreviewable authority, and he, especially in his second term now, is using that party to do the kind of transactional work he always does, which is punish his enemies and reward his friends.
Zachary?
I not to pivot our conversation completely away from pardons, but I'm also curious what you make, given the sort of strange position of Trump having now serving a second non-consecutive term, about his relationship with the Supreme Court, many of whose members he appointed. How do you think the Supreme Court and Chief Justice Roberts in particular have tried to position themselves relative to the Trump administration? And obviously it's still early to say, but how has the Trump administration sort of postured itself regarding the court?
Well, I think Chief Justice Roberts kind of wants things both ways. He wants to maintain the appearance of an independent judiciary. He wants I think he believes in that. I think he doesn't like the idea of the judiciary being perceived as a rubber stamp for Donald Trump or any other president. However, if you look at his judicial philosophy, it's a lot closer to Donald Trump's than to any other recent president. I mean, the formative experience of young John Roberts' career was serving in the Reagan White House, in the White House Counsel's office, where there was this great concern that the post-Watergate reforms had weakened the president unduly. Now, I think many people disagree about that, but John Roberts certainly believed it. And if you look at his jurisprudence as a lawyer, as a lower court judge, and now for many years as Chief Justice, he has been someone who believes in expansive judicial power. So when these cases start to come up to him, as they will from the second Trump term, I expect that far more often than not, he will ratify what Trump has done. But at the same time, he wants to appear, and I think he is still leading an independent of government, one that just happens to agree with the executive.
Interesting. But there have to be major differences between them over, for example, birthright citizenship and things of that sort.
Maybe. Maybe. I'm not prepared to say that. Of all the legal controversies that have come up in this brief period that Trump has been president for a second time, birthright citizenship is the only one that I feel somewhat confident Roberts would rule against Trump. I mean, I think the Constitution is sufficiently clear and the precedents are sufficiently venerable and respected that the idea that John Roberts would not want to upset the apple cart of birthright citizenship, that, you know, people born in the United States are citizens. That's been true for 100 years in this country, and I don't think that'll change. But if you look at all the other controversies, whether it's about immigration or federal spending or Elon Musk, I think Roberts is a better than even chance for voting for the Trump position rather than against it.
So you think that there's a legitimate point of view that Roberts would have, that the executive can close agencies that Congress has by statute created?
Well, not to be too much of a lawyer with you, but I think it depends what you mean by close.
Right.
For example, the Department of Education is something I know something about, and they have statutorily ordained programs like Title I, which gives money to lower income school districts
or Fulbright.
They have full grade scholarships or Pell Grants to students who are going to college. As long as those programs continue, for example, the Trump administration has said that student loans, which is a big part of what Department of Education does, will now be administered by the Small Business Administration. So I think that's permissible. And as long as there is something called the Department of Education, which may wind up having a dozen employees, I think that's consistent. I think that's something Roberts could endorse. That as long as the programs that Congress funds are intact and there is something called the Department of Education, which Congress created, I think he'd likely allow it.
So I guess, Jeff, our closing question, we always like to close on one that sort of brings this history and contemporary analysis together in useful ways for people who care about democracy, as we all do, I hope. What are the ways that those of us as citizens who care about some rough balance between the different branches, what are the ways we can encourage the courts to continue to play the role they should play? How can we as a citizen body, I think we all have a sense of how we can try to influence Congress, call our members of Congress, and we can try to influence presidential elections by getting involved in presidential elections. But how do we as citizens influence the courts?
Well, that's a great question. And I think one of the good things about our court system is that the public can't influence them much. They are an independent judiciary, and they serve for life for a reason. What I think citizens can do is vote for president and vote for particularly for the Senate and listen to what the candidates have to say about the kind of judges they will appoint. You know, one of the frustrations to me about covering politics as I do is that candidates don't talk enough about what kind of judges they will appoint and what those judges will stand for. So I think by the time federal judges are appointed, it's really too late. And frankly, it's good that it's too late, that the public can't influence what the judges do in any individual case. I think judicial independence in that regard is very important. But there was a big difference between the kind of judges Kamala Harris and the kind of judges Donald Trump would appoint. And that's something that people should think about when they're casting their votes. And the same thing with senators. Who will they vote to confirm judges who believe one set of things or another? So in that respect, it is a matter of voting, but it's a matter of paying attention to a set of issues that I think most voters don't, and they should.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. If I can squeeze in a short follow-on, what kinds of questions should we be asking? Because it seems to me when we do talk about, especially Supreme Court appointments, it's usually about whether the judge would be in favor of abortion rights or not. It's about a substantive issue, not about the kind of jurisprudence they bring to the court, which seems to me what you're more interested in, right?
I'm interested in both. I have a pretty crude approach to this sort of thing. You know, John Kerry, whom I interviewed when he ran for president in 2004, I always remember what he said to me. He said, of course I'm going to ask judges if they would vote to uphold Roe versus Wade if I appoint them to the Supreme Court. And I have absolutely no problem with that. I think it's something very important to know about whether someone should be appointed and whether they should be confirmed by the Senate. It's also true that, you know, judicial philosophy matters a lot. If, you know, a president says he will appoint originalists, that tells you a lot about what kind of judges. That is, judges who believe that the Constitution should be interpreted as the words of the Constitution were understood at the time the Constitution was ratified. That tells you a lot about what kind of rulings there will be. But at the same time, I am happy to go issue by issue, whether it's gun control, whether it's abortion, whether it's church-state relations, and see what these people do, because those decisions have a tremendous impact on how life is lived here.
Well said. Well said. Zachary, to close out, what do you think about that? Do you think that what Jeff is laying out very eloquently here, a focus more intently in election seasons on the kinds of people one would appoint to judicial roles, do you think that's something that young people will get interested in and pay attention to?
I think so. I think it's also part of how a lot of young people, particularly those who care most about issues like abortion or LGBTQ rights, are already thinking about elections and their relationship to the judiciary. I think that these kinds of discussions in recent years have become so much more normal around elections. I mean, just look, for example, at Wisconsin state Supreme Court races that have completely centered on major political issues of the day. And I think also there's some evidence that people voted that way even in the latest presidential election. So I think we're already moving in that direction.
That makes sense. That makes sense. And it's good to remind our listeners, those of you in Wisconsin in particular, there is an April 1st election for Supreme Court judge in Wisconsin. Make sure you vote if you are in Wisconsin now. Jeff, Zachary, thank you for this discussion. I think this really highlighted how vital the judiciary is to our democracy, a point Alexander Hamilton certainly understood, and how important it is for all of us to be aware, and as Jeff has told us, to be engaged with these issues when we make our choices at the ballot box, when we get involved in our politics and our activism, and when we think about our history as well. Jeffrey Toobin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks to you both.
Jeffrey Toobin's book, again, he's written a number of books, but the most recent one that I just read and highly recommend to everyone, The Pardon, The Politics of Presidential Mercy, really brings out something a number of us as historians have written a lot about, but Jeff has brought his focus and analysis to it as none of us have before, and really understanding the pardon and its strange role in American democracy, a role we all need to better understand as we go forward. Thank you, Zachary, for your scene-setting poem. By the way, the phrase that the poets are the legislators of our society, that comes from Percy Bysshe Shelley, one of the great poets of the 19th century, of course. Zachary, thank you for your poem today.
You're very welcome.
And thank you most of all to our loyal listeners and loyal subscribers to our Substack for joining us for this week of This Is Democracy.
This podcast is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio
and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.
The music in this episode was written and recorded by Harris Codini.
Stay tuned for a new episode every week.
You can find This Is Democracy on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube.
See you next time.